This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello there.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Hi.
More political upheaval in Europe. One of Europe's strongmen, Sebastian Kurz, resigned this week. To talk about the significance of this development, we'll go straight to Richard.
Yes, so on October 11th, Kurz was officially out in Austria to be replaced by his former foreign minister and loyalist, Alexander Schallenberg, who was sworn in as Austria's new chancellor. Now, this came about as a result of a pretty dramatic corruption scandal where internal police forces ended up raiding some of the Austria's own government offices and the and party offices. And basically, Kurz is accused of trying to manipulate things and bribe the media to get his way to power. So he's accused of funneling government advertising budgets to media outlets in exchange for favorable coverage. That's something that even, you know, just in the era of COVID, government advertising budgets have exploded. And to be honest, I kind of suspect quite a lot more countries of doing this, quietly funneling money from you know, spending lots in advertising with outlets that produce news coverage that favor the government. Perhaps more dramatically, he was accused of paying for manipulated opinion polls, again, with government money. So all as part of this kind of conspiracy almost to take over the government. So right when he became party leader, he's accused of manipulating opinion polls so that it looked like he was really popular and that everybody wanted him to take power immediately, and then using those manipulated opinion polls to get rid of the incumbent chancellor, to hold fresh elections with himself as the head, and to come into power. Now, a lot of this is accusations. There's not, say, a smoking gun pointing to any of the things that I've mentioned. This is all a big allegedly in front of all of that. What has been released, however, is text messages, which maybe are not directly incriminating. I don't think he texted any of his friends, "Hey, I manipulated the opinion polls, da 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 da." But it does show Kurz at the center of a pretty aggressive machinery that really gives the impression that they would stop at nothing to obtain power. And those text messages do kind of paint a grim picture for Mr. Kurz. So this is what came out. His initial reaction was to try and ride through it, to say that he was being persecuted by the security services. He was in coalition. He's in coalition with the Green Party. The Green Party called for his resignation. The Green Party then got together with a whole bunch of other German political parties who would have a majority in parliament and basically said, if you don't resign, we're all going to vote that we've got no confidence in you. We'll bring down the coalition and this will be the end of you. And so at that point, Mr. Kurz got up then, said, well, look, I'm just going to fall on my own sword for the good of the country, and so that this coalition remains intact and my one of my right hand men, Schallenberg, can take over as chancellor.
So let's talk about I'd like you to talk a little bit about kind of what Kurz represents for Austria and even Europe, because we've talked about just the era of strongmen taking over in Europe and how that really does align with the prophecies of the Bible. And we'll talk about that in a little later in the segment. But the fact that it was basically the coalition there in the government was basically able to force him out shows still kind of the limitations, if you will, of the the limitations, whether for good or ill, depending on how you view it, of a coalition system where you have someone of the kind of power that Kurtz has, who's able to be brought down at the hand of, say, a party that isn't necessarily a majority party, but is part of the government.
Yeah, I think Kurtz represents the future for the center-right in Europe, or at least that's what he did represent. You look at what's happened in Germany, for example, with their recent elections, and the center-right has been losing power with each election, and then in September they got their worst result in their post-war history. And really all of Western Europe has been seeing a similar trend with this decline in the center-right. And you know, as one leader put it, even within Germany this week, they said, well, look, the center right, we're not boring. I mean, we're boring. We're not appealing to young people. We have our core kind of loyalist voters that tend to often be pensioners and things like that. But we're not really exciting anyone. And for a whole lot of people, especially in Germany, Kurtz represented the way to turn that around, because that's what he did. He took a party that was going through that same process of just being maybe an elderly people's party, and it's traditional stalwarts, but it's not really picking up any new voters. It's steadily being declining in the polls. It's seeing new voters picked off by kind of exciting smaller parties, but ones that are newer. And Kurtz took that and completely changed their fortune. He reversed this decline. He started bringing back voters who had left for some of those minority parties. And he's a young guy. He did present this kind of exciting image. And so there are a whole lot of people in Germany pointing at Kurtz saying he's the way forwards. Mm-hmm. This is what we need. This is what we need to be like. And so, yeah, I think it's something that really does send an earthquake throughout Europe and start to raise some serious question marks within Germany. I think in some ways he makes the German election crisis, and especially the German election crisis for the center right, even worse. You know, their way out, their solution now suddenly looks like maybe it's not a solution after all. But the other thing that Kurtz really represented in Europe was a departure from traditional norms. He brought trends that we typically see in Eastern Europe into the West, where a lot of key positions in government he replaced with people who were loyal personally to him and with his supporters. So, you know, you're thinking about heads of the top universities, heads of state-owned media channels, various different regulators. And I think we've seen the left do this in the West for decades, where they've pretty much taken over all of these different institutions, which you can call the establishment or the deep state or whatever you like. But there's a whole bunch of institutions that the government has control over personnel, and the left have been incredibly good at getting their people in those positions. Sebastian Kurtz got a lot of his own people and people loyal to him into those positions, and top judges and things like that as well, to the point that people were wondering about the fate of free media or an independent judiciary in Austria. And he did seem to potentially point the way forwards to something where that takes a kind of strongman politics and even puts it on an undemocratic footing, a strongman that is kind of beyond accountability and beyond some of these checks and balances. And I think what happens now will be a real test of that. There are people saying, well, Kurtz may no longer be chancellor, but he's still going to be running Austria because of all of these personal ties to loyalty, because he's still the head of his party, which is then the largest party in the coalition government, and that he'll still be able to wield authority behind the scenes. We'll have to see what that happens, and I think a lot of that will come down to how loyal someone like Schallenberg is, whether he decides to strike out for himself or whether he continues to submit to Kurtz. But I think this is another question that it brings up for Europe, is how do we move forwards even in a democratic way? Both by the way he fell and what he did before then, you know, a lot of Europe sees the need for a strong leader, especially in the wake of Afghanistan. And we've talked about that before.
Right.
And you have someone like Kurz that is a strong personality. But if he's in a coalition and he can be brought down by a minority party, well, I think that does start to raise questions about how do we get a strong leader in a democracy? Do we need to start looking at changing our constitution so that we can have a strong and stable government? Because even with someone like Kurz, it looks like we might not be able to have that right now, where we can instead have a minority coalition party throwing us all into chaos. So I think all of these leadership questions and these big questions that are really focused in on Germany right now, but as they try and work out how are we going to move forwards from a disputed election and an election with no clear winner, I think Kurz's resignation makes a lot of those questions even harder to answer, at least in a democratic system.
Right. Well, that really does lead into the prophecy. Just remind our listeners what we can expect and what the Bible says will happen politically within Europe.
So our latest Key of David program from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory, the one that is up on the website today, Antiochus Rises in Europe. He really talks about this prophecy for a rise of a strong man in Europe and how it's one of the most important things for you to be watching right now. That it's an absolutely transformational event in world news. And he goes through a lot of the prophecy in that TV program. But he talks about how the book of Daniel is prophecy for this end time. That book makes that very clear. And that book talks about an Antiochus. It has these prophecies that were fulfilled by an ancient king Antiochus many centuries ago. But the book makes clear these are end time prophecies. There will be an end time Antiochus. And the book talks about him coming into power by flatteries. He doesn't come into power through ordinary channels. He is a strong leader. He's a ruthless leader. It talks about him understanding dark sentences. You know, he operates in a dark and underhand way. Mr. Flory explains all that in the Key of David program. But you can certainly see how he talked about how that strong leader can only come from Germany. And I think you see that in the decline of Kurz. You know, Kurz is not going to be that one strong leader. Mr. Flory also talked about how the Bible says there's going to be 10 kings and potentially Kurz could still be one of those 10. He's not going to be the overall leader, though. That can only come from Germany. So the Bible tells us to watch for a strong leader coming into power and not ruling in a democratic way. And so seeing democracy trip up a strong leader that was kind of trying some of that in Austria, I think really puts the focus on this strong leader and the undemocratic nature of what is coming soon for Germany and Europe.
Well, thank you very much for that. We do have an article up on the website by Josue Michels, Crises Sweep Away Europe's Leaders Temporarily. He also draws attention to a crisis that has occurred in the Czech Republic, and we will link to that in the show notes, as well as that Key of David program new this weekend, Antiochus Rises in Europe. Thank you very much for that, Richard. Violence broke out in Beirut yesterday, sparking fears of the potential for civil war in Lebanon. For this story, we'll turn to Brent Noctegal.
Lebanon is always a volatile country, and right now its economic situation is so dire. It just had over 24 hours of no power for anyone. That was last week. And then this week saw a lot of violence on the streets and a lot of weaponry on the streets from both sides that were included in this violence. So what basically is happening that caused this flare-up where seven people were killed and dozens others were injured is that you have this ongoing probe into the cause behind the Beirut blast back on August 4th. And the chief judge that is going up, the man that's in charge of the prosecution or going after the evidence and trying to find who's at fault, his name is Tariq Bitar. And he is seen by those people that the family members of those that were killed as a really unbiased figure. And evidence of this is because he's called for the first questioning of two very powerful Shiite MPs. and they didn't come and take questions. And so he called, put out an arrest warrant for one of them, which is just really the fact that this judge had the gall to do that is really shaking up the political class, because he's showing that he's not scared to bring anyone to task for any type of role in allowing that Beirut blast again to take place. This is the blast that killed over 200 people, that basically leveled the ocean front, the front of the port of Beirut back on August 4th, 2020. And so what you had yesterday was Shiite groups, Hezbollah and Amal, two of the biggest Shiite groups. They marched on and protested at the front of the Palace of Justice, which is basically the high court where this is going down, calling for the removal of Bitar, from saying that he's a biased judge, he needs to go, he's horrible. And so they were really voicing their desire to remove him. And as the Shiite forces crossed into the Palace of Justice, which is in a Christian neighborhood, then there were snipers from a nearby building that started to take out some of these protesters, at which point Hezbollah was ready to go. I mean, I think the biggest shock for observers of what happened yesterday was the amount of weapons, small arms, anti-tank weapons that were available for Hezbollah to use almost instantaneously to return fire on these buildings. And it was scenes reminiscent of the civil war in the 70s, 80s inside Lebanon, where you had a road, and then you had in between the road, you had massive amounts of barrages of fire, small arms fire from one side to the other, and then back. And it was like that for hours. The tanks and the Lebanese military were called in. They basically sat a little bit of a ways off and let the two sides go at it. And at the end of the day, seven people killed. Looks like there's some calm restored. However, I mean, people are just looking at this situation and seeing how quickly it got out of hand, and how Hezbollah itself, there was footage of convoys of Hezbollah fighters headed up from the south of Lebanon to this part of town, coming to make sure it doesn't get out of hand. There weren't more pictures of the Lebanese military coming to put down the violence. No, Hezbollah was going to come and finish it off to make sure it didn't get out of hand. And I think many people around the world, and even Lebanese, are wondering, wow, that got close to getting extremely out of hand.
That is really remarkable how quickly that escalated between these two. But the tensions between the Lebanese people and Hezbollah have been building over quite a number of years. And we've talked quite a lot about how Hezbollah's presence in that country really is they're sort of serving as proxies for Iran in that country. And there are a lot of Lebanese that are really uncomfortable with that. The Beirut blast seemed to bring some of those tensions to a head very quickly. That hasn't gone away, and this is an indication of the fact that this is still unresolved.
Yeah, it's still unresolved, and I think Hezbollah is increasingly exposed, because it is being seen as, both Hezbollah and Amal, the other Shiite organization, or Shiite political force, I suppose, they're being exposed as getting in the way of the judiciary into a important investigation that killed Lebanese, and it killed Christian Lebanese as well. They're the main people along the port front. They're Christians that live there, away from the Shiite strongholds. And so you've got a desire for justice. What was 2,750 tons of ammonia nitrate doing at the port of Beirut for a decade? The answer to that question needs to be answered. And the Christians whose families were affected, they are going to get an answer. And when all the fingers point to the Shiites, or at least to Amal and perhaps Hezbollah at that, I think it's most people know it's going to be Hezbollah. When they can't get justice for such a horrific act that almost leveled the capital city, then you do see forces rise up against Hezbollah. And while nobody wants a civil war, I think that's where this type of scenario, that's where we're headed in Lebanon. Michael Young wrote for Diwan today. He's a good commentator. He said this: whether the Lebanese want it or not, their country is now locked in a logic of civil war. That doesn't mean war will happen. In fact, it may not, but the groundwork is certainly taking form. Armed groups are defining their sectarian territories. The state appears too weak to prevent hostile actions, and the economic situation is catastrophic, which means there's a large pool of young men who can be recruited into militias. And so that's the situation in Lebanon, and this is something we have expected, not just during the Beirut, because of the Beirut blast, but even before that. Mr. Fleury wrote in 2014 that he expected a civil war to erupt inside Lebanon again, one that would see Hezbollah, Iranian-backed Hezbollah, actually losing power in Lebanon, because that's what biblical prophecy says. Iran is going to lose power in Lebanon based on a prophecy found in Psalm chapter 83, which Lebanon is in an anti-Iranian alliance. We have literature we can send people about that, but we expect a massive shift in the power, who holds the power in Lebanon, away from Iran and Hezbollah. And then the Beirut blast really did expose, again, the subjugation that Hezbollah has put on the Lebanese people by being put in charge there. And so we are seeing this bubble away, and now it's gotten violent. And nobody expects, I think, the violence to go away. Not especially not if this judge keeps on probing Hezbollah for their fault in the Beirut blast.
Yeah, not to mention the fact that you have Lebanese who are willing to serve as snipers when they see Hezbollah marching on the courthouse. The name of that Gerald Fleury article that you referenced.
This was the October 2020 Trumpet. Why We Told You to Watch Lebanon is Mr. Fleury's personal from that.
All right. Thank you very much for that. Brent, over to Japan now, where an eye-popping pledge was made by the new ruling party under its new prime minister. For this, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, Japan's ruling party just pledged to make an unprecedented increase in military spending. They said that they will double the country's current budget. So for decades, Japan has had a limit on its defense spending set at 1% of gross domestic product. They couldn't spend any more than that. And that limit has been in place largely to ease concerns both inside Japan and abroad about any just potential revival of the kind of militarism that led Japan into World War II. But the Liberal Democratic Party that rules Japan is now saying people can be concerned if they want to, but we will now boost that number from 1% of GDP to 2%. So, you know, 1%, 2%, these sound like small numbers, but Japan has the world's third largest economy. Its GDP is more than $5 trillion. So 2% of that would be in the neighborhood of $100 billion per year. Right now, Japan is in ninth place on the list of countries ranked by how much they spend on defense. But this increase to $100 billion will move Japan ahead of France, Germany, Saudi Arabia, the UK, and even Russia and India. So it would put Japan at third place behind only the US and China. So it's a real quantum leap that Japan's going to make here if it all goes according to plan. It's just an unheard of increase. And it shows that the new prime minister, Fumio Kishida, is determined to carry his predecessor, Shinzo Abe's, torch. Abe was hawkish. He was intent on normalizing Japan's military. And actually, with this announcement this week, we may be seeing that Kishida is even more hawkish than Abe, and that Japan under him could be militarily transformed and normalized even faster.
What is motivating this kind of desire to increase or double their military spending?
It's mostly China. There was a survey taken of the Japanese public a few months ago. This was by the Nikkei Business Daily. And 86% of respondents said that China posed a threat to Japan. That's even ahead of the 82% who expressed concerns about a nuclear-armed North Korea. So China is becoming more and more belligerent by the day, really. And that is shifting public sentiment in Japan away from those kind of historic concerns about rearming and toward fears of China's military aggression. So that's why the LDP is floating this idea, and why I think it's very likely that they'll be able to pass it.
And what are they interested in doing with that massive increase in spending?
Well, Japan's military strategy focuses heavily on naval power. They already have the second most powerful navy in the world, just behind the U.S. And this increase of, you know, some $50 billion will continue to build on that naval power. They're expected to buy more American equipment, including more of those F-35 stealth fighters like the one we spoke about last week that's now being used on Japan's aircraft carriers. And they'll also buy more Osprey tilt-rotor utility aircraft from the U.S. And then Japan also has big plans in the works to develop more of their own weapons. So that includes indigenous stealth fighters and amphibious landing craft, warships, aircraft carriers, and submarines as well. So this kind of thing is all crucial for a strong navy, and it looks like that will remain Japan's focus. Geopolitical strategist Peter Zion wrote about this on Wednesday. And he said, quote, "Japan does not functionally have an army. It's all navy. And it is already the second most capable navy in the world. Now they're going to double spending, not a small development." Mm-hmm. End quote. So this is just, it's raising a lot of eyebrows, because Japan is already an incredibly formidable naval power. And if it goes according to this new plan, it'll just boost Japan's naval power that much more.
It seems like whenever we hear reports, headlines, and stories about major military developments, they're always coming from Asia. We hear it from Russia, we hear it from China, we're hearing it from Japan. Could you just put this in context of prophecy for us, and why this is significant, how we would expect this to play out eventually, even though you've got Japan here that is basically arming itself to try to defend against Chinese aggression, that's not going to stay that way.
Yes, yeah, there is really a region-wide arms race underway in Asia right now, and that is perfectly in line with what we would expect from the prophecies of the Bible. Revelation 16:12 tells us that one of the main alliances in World War III will be a group of Asian nations that is, it's called the Kings of the East in that passage. And if you look at Ezekiel 38, it tells us who some of the specific players in that alliance will be. It says Russia will be at the head of it, and that China will be in it. And then verse 6 even gives some ancient names that indicate modern Japan, showing that, you know, Japan will be part of that end time Asian military force. So yeah, you're exactly right. Right now, Japan is arming out of fear of China. A lot of the arming and military buildup that's happening across Asia is happening in response to fear, you know, by one Asian country of another Asian country. Mm-hmm. But from these passages, we know that eventually those fears will be trumped by another, you know, fear that will convince Japan and China and Russia and all these others to amalgamate all of their militaries together in this massive power block.
Where would you send people for more information about the prophecies that we're talking about here?
We have an article. It's called Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Toward Militarism, that lays out a lot of those prophecies. And then we also have a booklet called Russia and China in Prophecy, which goes beyond just Russia and China. There's a whole chapter in there about Japan, another one about India, and it really just shows the big picture of what we should expect based on the Bible's forecasts.
All right. Thank you very much, Jeremiah. Inflation in America is now being compounded by supply chain issues and shortages. How bad is this going to get? For this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, America is starting to run out of just about everything. If you've been to a grocery store recently, you've probably noticed a few empty shelves, and the fact that everything is about 5 to 10% more expensive than it used to be. And if you've ordered anything online, you've also probably noticed some pretty low inventories and some pretty long waits for things. I personally waited at transmission go on a car and waited 8 weeks for the new part to get that fixed, and have had quite the time trying to find matching curtains for my house, and that they seem to only be three or four of any given color anywhere you look.
This is what got you into this story. It's the curtains.
It's the curtains. I had to start digging into this. And I found out some pretty shocking stuff. Some pretty shocking stuff here. It's definitely not something that's going away anytime soon. The U.S. Transportation Secretary, Pete Buttigieg, came out recently and basically said the government expects these to last for a few years. These shortages, and although what he's not mentioning is that him and the people who work for him in the Department of Transportation saw this coming before you locked down the economy. You don't. This doesn't take a ton of a huge intellect or a ton of effort to just sit down and kind of like plot this out step by step. That if you lock down the global economy like they did in April 2020, that millions of people are going to lose their jobs and millions of dollars of trade are going to be lost. The only way for the government to stop a devastating depression is to spend trillions of dollars, which they did. I think close as I could calculate, all the governments around the world spent about $16 trillion wow. in COVID stimulus, about 20% of the planet's gross domestic product. Hmm. But then when you reopen the economy, what happens? It's like, oh, well, people start buying stuff again, and they actually buy more stuff than they did before because
they've
got
catching up.
Because they've got stimulus money, and they're trying to catch up on what they couldn't get there. But your workforce is low because you laid mm-hmm. everybody off, and not all of them have come back. Some of them retired early. Some of them just decided to not work. So now you've got low workforce, high demand, shipping prices go up an order of magnitude, literally. I think the price for one of those big 40-foot boxes you see on the boats that comes from China over here has gone from like $2,000 a box to $20,000 a box.
Whoa.
To move that there, and so obviously you divide that shipping cost by all the stuff in the box, but it's it's a huge cost, and it's really shined a spotlight on something that's really important in the fact that like just how vital supply chains are to the world. It's something you normally take for granted, but if you study like any like World War II, World War I, the Russian Civil War, it's like any war that disrupts supply chains, it's like the supply chain disruptions generally kill about 10 times more people than the bullets do. I think it was like the Russian Civil War killed about 10 million people, and then 1 million actually just got shot in the warfare, and then another 9 million died in the famine and the disease and the other problems that arise when all your supply chains for food and medicine and stuff like that don't work anymore. And so right now what we're seeing is really kind of a self-inflicted wound that world leaders have done to us by doing this lockdown. And it's going to take a few years to get over that if they don't start doing climate lockdowns or something else crazy. But it does show that like when you start looking at Bible prophecies, like the ones in Isaiah 23, Ezekiel 27 and 28, about like a global trade siege. I mean, how much worse would it be when instead of having to pay $20,000 from the box from China, just the box don't the Chinese just stop sending them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you'd see the shortages you see now times 100, but
yeah. Well, it is a shot across the bow, isn't it? The dependence that we have on these vulnerable supply chains and just all of the infrastructure that we require in order to just get basic goods, our food and, you know, necessities that are delivered from places all over the world. As soon as something gets in the way of that, then you start having serious problems. This is the worst supply chain collapse in modern history.
Right, because even domestically, I've heard people point out before that America could be food self-sufficient. You wouldn't have to order food from other countries. It would cost more, obviously, because they force the supply. But even that, even within the country, like the average piece of food you eat travels about 1,500 miles, 1,500 miles to get to your plate. Now, some of it comes closer, some of it comes farther, but it averages out for that. So, like I said, you start getting like civil war like conditions, like you're talked about in prophecies like Ezekiel 5, where those truck lines don't work anymore. And you'll find very quickly that when you can't ship stuff, it's there's probably nothing being for people in the cities, there's nothing being grown they can eat for miles and miles and miles and miles.
Mm-hmm. Well, it does bring to mind some of those very disturbing prophecies of conditions that we can expect to see in the United States and other nations very soon. Andrew is working on a feature on this subject that will be printed in the coming print edition of The Trumpet. We're sending that to the printer next week, so you can expect for more information about that coming on thetrumpet.com and in the print magazine. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, we're going to look at the state of America's dealings with the Taliban in Afghanistan. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
After America's shameful evacuation from Afghanistan at the end of July, what's happening in that country has virtually dropped out of the news cycle because we're overwhelmed with other bad news. To bring us up to speed with what is going on in Afghanistan, we'll go back to Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, now we're getting to the point where the Taliban is trying to figure out how they rule over a country that they haven't really cared too much about. That means the citizens of that country. And the United States and the rest of the international community have to start thinking, what are they going to do to keep Afghanis from starving to death? And this is where we're at now with the U.S. withdrawal, with the Taliban in charge. This past weekend, we had the United States sitting down with the Taliban in Doha in Qatar, and they had a candid and professional chat. That's what Ned Price said, the spokesman of the State Department, about what they're going to do in their relationship going forward. And the big question is, will the United States contribute aid to the Taliban or aid to Afghanistan? It's going to be hard to differentiate between the two. Mm-hmm. And the United States, at least the Taliban says, is going to contribute monetary assistance to keep the Afghani people from starving. This money apparently is said it is not going to go directly to the Taliban, but it will go to NGOs inside the country to try and, again, just mitigate the dire situation that a lot of Afghanis are in. And so one of the two things that the United States people were probably satisfied with the exit, wasn't the way it was done, but the fact that no more blood and no more treasure will be spent in Afghanistan. Well, the Biden administration tells you blood might not be spent there, but treasure is indeed going to continue to be, American treasure is going to continue to be spent inside Afghanistan, this in the form of foreign aid. We don't know how much money yet, but the United States has agreed to do it.
Anyone with any foresight could have seen this coming from 100 miles away. You take a terrorist organization, you put them in charge of a country, any country, but a country the size of Afghanistan, the sprawling country. This is a bizarre situation. American officials sitting down with terrorists trying to figure out how to feed people in a country that we were present in just a short time ago.
Right. And that's exactly, you know, what is happening. 14 of the 33 ministers in the Taliban's government are designated as terrorists, not just by the United States, but also the United Nations. One of them has a $10 million, the Interior Ministry, again, in charge of the Interior, who is meant to be overseeing the safety, safeguarding the Afghani people in this future, in this state. He's got a $10 million US dollar bounty on his head right now by the US government. And so you have this bizarre situation where the United States is going to start funding a terrorist state. And yes, you do feel for the Afghani people. What are they to do? But typically when you take over country, the burden of looking after a country falls on those which have taken it over. And it doesn't seem like it's going to be that way. The Taliban have their revenue streams, not enough, but all their opioid trade and such, they don't have enough, I suppose, to feed all of Afghanistan. However, this is massive leverage, right? This is massive leverage for the United States. If you want some changes, if you think the Taliban is capable of changing their modus operandi of no longer being a terrorist organization, then say no aid to your country. But obviously they're not going to do that because they know that the Taliban doesn't care about their own citizens. Mm. The international community cares more about Afghanis than the Taliban does. And so you're going to have this weird scenario where the Taliban is going to be free to do their terrorist activities, and the rest of the world, including the United States, is going to foot the bill to keep Afghanistan afloat, even after U.S. servicemen have left. This is a bizarre scenario. It's one kind of similar to what happened in Iran, where the United States decided that we're going to have a nuclear deal. It's meant to slow Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons. And for that, they get $150 billion of unfrozen assets that goes into their coffers, and they get access to the international markets. Now, this nuclear deal was a front to fund the Iranian regime. The United States funded the Iranian regime, gave them access to lots of money to continue what they were going to do. And now we have a similar situation that's going to persevere inside Afghanistan as well with the Taliban. This is shocking. And it's again, as Mr. Flory wrote in the latest Trumpet magazine, this isn't incompetence, though. This is treason, meaning this was planned. This is chaos by design by the United States. They knew that the Taliban couldn't look after Afghanistan by themselves. They know that they're going to need money to do it. And so the United States, and again, with the suffering of the Afghani people on the line, it's going to be an easy sell, I believe. That the United States and other foreign nations are going to start pumping money into Afghanistan. And you would have to be absolutely crazy to think that that money is not going to go into the hands of the Taliban.
This isn't incompetence. This is treason, is the title of Gerald Flory's cover story from the latest Trumpet edition. If you haven't read it, please do so. Very critical insight into what the United States has done over there in Afghanistan. Thank you for that, Brent. Europe has a real problem with terrorism, especially Islamic radicalization. Attacks this week brought this problem to the surface. For this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, as a start, I'll just mention one brief piece of breaking news. The Conservative MP, Sir David Ames, it's just been announced that he has died after being stabbed multiple times at his constituency surgery. So that's just where the MP meets with members of his local area. So he's from the Conservative Party, a right-wing MP. He's from the kind of pro-Brexit wing of the party. At this point, we don't know anything about the murder, really. It was done by a 25-year-old man. That's about all we know. So we don't know his background or his motivations. But just a tragic piece of news that's just kind of breaking while we're recording the show, and one that is definitely going to rock the UK and have continued fallout as this moves on and as we know more. But the main story I was going to bring you, though, comes from Norway. Another pretty disturbing story, really, where on Wednesday evening, you had a man go through just a medium-sized town in Norway, Kongsberg, with a bow and arrow, apparently just shooting at random, shooting indiscriminately. He killed five people and left three injured. And the man in question, he's a 37-year-old Danish citizen who reportedly converted to Islam and was on a watch list maintained by the police for people that could potentially have been radicalized. And the chief of Norwegian Police and Security Services told reporters on Thursday that it appears that it may have been an act of terrorism. So a particularly gruesome and therefore eye-catching terrorist attack in Norway. And unfortunately, that's what terrorism, I guess, is all about, is trying to grab those headlines with those kind of attacks.
Well, put this in context for us. This isn't an isolated terrorist attack. Europe has experienced a lot of this type of thing. What are the effects of such attacks?
It has. There have been quite a number of these attacks. And I think one of the things that stands out is just the variety of weapons used. This is the first time we've seen a bow and arrow, but we've had cars, lorries, I think there was one, just small arms or shotguns and then other larger assault rifles, that kind of thing. So a wide variety of weapons. And so I think you do start to get this picture building in Europe of terrorist attacks that are very hard to stop by kind of by the kind of weapons-based approach, say, that Europe has really developed so far, where they've just tried to crack down on particular weapons and things like that. And you know, you see, you ban guns and people try killing people with lorries. You can certainly, it's certainly harder to kill people with some weapons than others, but you can see how that kind of weapons-based approach does have major limitations. And so all of this is just leading to a Europe that's getting more and more disturbed about what is happening with radical Islam and looking for different solutions rather than, say, just banning particular weapons. So this is something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry also talked about in today's Key of David, that there are very important prophecies about Europe ruling or Europe having this confrontation with the Middle East, this strong German leader, this Antiochus figure, having a confrontation with the Middle East and with radical Islam. And when you see these kind of terrorist attacks in Europe, you can certainly see that confrontation building. I mean, you see it in another separate story that we've got going up on the website soon is talking about the new Czech leader. And he talks very vocally about Europe getting more involved in the Middle East because of these kind of terrorist attacks. He was making those comments, I think, ahead of Wednesday. But you can certainly see those comments becoming much more common as we see these kind of attacks. So this is right in line with Bible prophecy. Like I said, Mr. Flurry talks about it on today's show. We also have our free booklet, The King of the South, that explains the Bible prophecies of this coming clash in much more detail.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that, Richard. More evidence is emerging of the massive scale of China's theft of American intellectual property. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yeah, a very interesting article was published in the Epoch Times this week about the Chinese Communist Party's ongoing theft of American technology and intellectual property. This article is built on an interview with Evan Anderson, the CEO of the INVNT media company. And it goes into a lot of what we've covered before on Trumpet Hour about just how much China's stealing and how much this advances China's efforts to overtake the U.S. economically and militarily. And then Anderson goes into some, what I think are some really fascinating details about something that doesn't come up as often that enables all this Chinese theft. And that is a set of national security laws that require companies and individuals to follow any order the government gives them, including orders to steal. So one quote from him says, by Chinese law, Companies cannot refuse to work for the Chinese Communist Party. The national security laws that have been passed in China actually mean in writing that any Chinese citizen or anyone that's ethnically Chinese abroad is technically subservient to their government. So, you know, this applies not just to China's people at home, but also to Chinese people living in the U.S. or any other country. And it means that the Chinese regime can mobilize basically the whole of society in its efforts to steal foreign technology and IP.
So talk about just the scale of what China has been up to here, how much this has cost the United States.
Actually, I don't know if you want to hear this. It's a nauseating amount of theft that's happening here. FBI Director Christopher Wray talked about the scale of it last year. He described it as, quote, so massive that it represents one of the largest transfers of wealth in human history. End quote. And if you want to put a number on it, an IP Commission report by the National Bureau of Asian Research said that every year this theft costs the U.S. as much as $600 billion. So it's just almost an unbelievable amount of stealing that's happening here. And thanks to China's national security laws, it doesn't look like that'll be reduced anytime soon.
This really is probably one of the biggest factors that has contributed to China's rise at America's expense in recent years. What does prophecy say about this this development?
Yeah, well, there's a passage or a chapter, Deuteronomy 28, which goes through several specific ways that God promises he would bless Israel, which there refers to the U.S. and the U.K. mostly, if those nations turned to him, and also some specific ways that he would punish them if they rejected him. And one of the specific curses is in verse 33, and it says, the fruits of the labor of, you know, the U.S. would be stolen and consumed by an outside power. And that's exactly what's happening. America is rejecting God, and as a result, God is allowing the fruits of U.S. labor to be stolen and consumed by an outside power. So it's exactly as he warned would happen in that prophecy. And we have an article called China Steals U.S. Trade Secrets and Fulfills Bible Prophecy. It goes through that passage there that I just mentioned in Deuteronomy and several other relevant scriptures as well. So for any listeners who would like to understand this in the prophetic context, I would recommend that article.
Okay, thank you for that, Jeremiah. One final story. Donald Trump has been pretty active lately, leading political rallies. His primary message is quite provocative, even prophetically intriguing. For this, we'll go to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, a lot of Republicans right now are gearing up for the midterm elections next year, and then the big presidential elections 2 years after that. But Donald Trump's taken a fairly unique political message that's saying that probably neither of those elections will probably matter much unless Republicans do the work to expose voter fraud first. Now, the Maricopa County, Arizona audit came out recently, and we've talked about that on this program already, which exposed 700,000 issues and irregularities with that election. And they estimate that probably when you consider that many ballots had several issues, that there's probably 50,000 ballots in that election that just are fraudulent ballots. And so on Wednesday, Mr. Trump, he released this statement. He said, if we don't solve the presidential election fraud of 2020, which we have thoroughly and conclusively documented, Republicans will not be voting in 22 and 24. It's the single most important thing for Republicans to do. I found that statement interesting about just the Republicans. It's like it really wouldn't matter if they voted in those upcoming elections unless they do the work of exposing the election fraud. Because there's a statement our editor-in-chief wrote in his last big article on the election crisis, what will happen after Trump regains power, where he says, it certainly seems to me that Trump will regain power before the next presidential election in 2024, unless there's some kind of war and voting combined. But 2 Kings 14 and verse 28 does not even hint of an election. And so it's definitely giving the statement there that it really seems that like something's going to happen before the next election to expose this fraud. And Donald Trump's talking the same way right now, that saying, hey, if the Republicans don't do the work to expose what happened last election, mm-hmm. then it's almost not worth voting next election because they'll just do it again.
Right. Well, it's a very good point. And as Stephen Fleury has been saying on the Trumpet Daily program, Donald Trump is still the most popular politician in the country. There are a whole lot of people who are still very enthusiastic in supporting him. And when he comes out and makes those kinds of statements, you know, there are going to be a whole lot of people that will be fired up and doing what they can to try to support him in that. We will see the way that plays out. What will happen after Trump regains power is the title of the article of Gerald Fleury, and he explains why the Trumpet still believes that somehow, some way, he's going to get back into power. We thank you very much for that, Andrew. I'm Joel Hilliker. That's it for today's Trumpet Hour. Email us your thoughts on the program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Parker Campbell for engineering and production. I'll leave you with the words of Claire Booth Luce. Courage is the ladder on which all other virtues mount. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.